I love our new music so much. It's so happy and hopeful.
I like it a lot. Good job, guys. Good job, everyone.
Good find. Danny. Good find on that. Danny, producer Danny. Big round of applause. Guys, we're so excited because today on the Game Diaries, we have a very special mini-sode for you. We've got Rebecca Heinemann, Burger Becky, here to talk with us about the episode that we did on her and the 40-year anniversary of esports and her being a champion. And she's here right now. Can we bring her in?
Yes. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so excited.
Hey, I am too. I'm just so glad that this... I was pleasantly surprised when I saw the topic of the very first episode of the Game Diaries, and I was like... They're talking about me.
We must have done something special because we're so lucky to have you today with us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been, 40 years since I won that tournament, and I still remember it. And, unfortunately, most of the gaming world doesn't.
That was like one of the things that Stephanie and I discovered as I was telling her the story. Like, Stephanie is a esports champion. She's won 5 like world championships. She's a badass. But she wasn't aware of your entire story. And I was like, so many people need to know your story. And I was glad recently to see you were covered in the Netflix documentary High Score as well. So I'm glad your story is getting out there, especially now for the 40-year anniversary, which I think actually is like this week. The finals were, I think, November 10th, maybe?
Yes. The regional for New York, which was the last regional, was November 8th. And that was on a Saturday. And then Monday, November 10th, was when we had the finals.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. That's such a long time ago.
November 6th, so it's only 4 days away from being the 40th anniversary.
Wow. Well, I feel we're so lucky that we're so lucky to be able to celebrate this with you. I have questions for you. I know Stephanie does too, but I have questions for you about the tournament itself. But first, I want to talk about the night that you picked up your Apple II computer. Because there's this, Stephanie and I like see your life like a movie. We see, like to us, it like plays like a movie. And that scene of you finding the Apple II computer in the Penny Saver and contacting someone and riding to their house in the middle of the night on a bicycle and getting the computer all the way back to your house. I want to know a little bit more about that night.
Well, it was not the night I wanted to remember.
Really?
It was one of those it was a long night. Because being an ignorant little child, I was like 16, but even though I rode around areas of Whittier on my bicycle, and I was pretty fast, pretty athletic back then, it didn't dawn on me that riding from the west side of Whittier, which is Whittier, Pico Rivera, the border, that's basically where I lived, to a house that's just south of Los Angeles Airport was about a 1.5 hour bike ride when I was unencumbered. But, I was just riding. And, of course, when I left home, it was daylight. So I left home, rode there, got to the guy's house. And, of course, I was more concerned whether that this... this was all legit, and I just wasted my time. I mean, the whole thing occurred was I had a friend who I'd visit his house all the time, and he had an Apple II computer, and that's where I got the computer bug about for an Apple II, because I was using an AIM 65 and saw people with other MSI and other computers, but this Apple II really, really wanted one. And then there was this newsletter that they give away every week in the in the LA area called the Penny Saver. And it's essentially a paper form of Craigslist. And in there, somebody was selling an Apple II computer for $600. Now, to put it in perspective, comparable machines of that type was like $1,000 to $1,200. So he's basically selling at half price. Uh-huh. My first reaction was like, this is either a scam or he stole it or what. But I just called the guy, said, yep, I got it. Come on down, bring me the cash, and it's yours. So I just literally got on my bike, hour and a half later, I got to this guy's house, and turns out that his story that he gave me was that his company bought a bunch of computers, but they bought too many. And they just need to get rid of some of them. And he says, yeah, they're selling. He just wow. wanted to get rid of them now. That's the story he gave me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it fell off a truck or something. I wasn't questioning these things. But one thing I didn't realize was how big an Apple II box is. Because I was only expecting just the computer. The computer's like this big. Instead, there was this giant box. And it's like, oh my goodness. So I ended up having to, got the computer, opened it up, looked inside. Yeah, it's an Apple II computer. He's selling me the real thing. Gave him his money. Then I took the computer and the box, and I really couldn't ride anywhere because this thing was so freaking huge. But it turns out that, there was they sell bungee cords at gas stations. So oh, wow. I got a couple of them, and I bungeed them on my bike, and got on the bike, and I had to stand because the computer was on the seat.
Oh,
and
that's
I
how
rode,
you did it.
But I could only ride for like maybe a couple of blocks. Then I had to get off and walk the bike. And then it got dark. And instead of taking an hour and a half to get home, it was like about 3 to 5 hours. I got home really late that night, but I just kept going and going. And of course, there was always this terror in me, which somebody's going to see this Apple box. And rob me of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're in Los Angeles. Like, the greatest area.
Well, let's put it this way. South of the LA airport is not a nice neighborhood. And of course, you know, not all of it was because they had to go across the bridge that crosses from the LA River Bridge.
Oh, Lord.
And there was going through Washington Boulevard was the boulevard I went through from one side of LA to the other, because there's Slauson, which takes you to the airport, then there's Washington Boulevard, but there's Washington, which is the one that was familiar to bikes for what I was using. I bring in this big, big box, and of course my parents are like, you know,
where have you been?
Blah, blah, blah kind of thing. For me, I just rode into the garage, put the bike there, put the box down, and then I'd left the box and everything in the garage. Shut the garage door, went into the house. Actually, it's one where you get out of the garage, close the garage door, because there was no entrance into the house from the garage. And then I went into the house, and then I got my usual yellings. And then after that, I just went to bed and slept. And it was the next day, but it was Sunday, I was able to go in there and open the box and get the computer out. And it wasn't until later when I realized, you know, I could have just taken the computer out of the box, put it in a backpack, and then toss the box. But I didn't think of it at the time.
No, you were just really excited.
I was. It was just, you know, I was so excited at getting an Apple II computer. And, you know, it had 16 glorious K of memory. And, I mean, this was the lowest end of the low-end Apple IIs. To put it in perspective, there was no floppy drives. It was just a computer. An RF modulator so I could hook it up to a TV, and 16K of memory, and I had to save all my files and cassette tapes.
You had the chance to listen to the first episode, or this episode, when we talked about you, Rebecca. So I was just wondering if there was things that potentially we got right or wrong, or things you forgot that happened that
we brought
up. Oh, some
of the things, when she was talking about it, I was going like, oh, yeah, I remember that. Oh, yeah, I remember that. I hope she... Oh, she talked about that. Oh, no.
I did some really serious research on you. Uh-huh. But you've got some great interviews out there. You really do. I know some of the timeline was off because it's a little hard. This era, like, wasn't really recorded very well. Like, it's all sort of just swept right under, I think, when the crash happened. And this era just sort of got forgotten. Like, I didn't realize at the tournament that you guys had, like, there were, like, shoutcasters that tried, kind of, to, you know, to
they
call
tried.
The tournament.
They tried. The regionals, there was nothing like that. But it was during the nationals that they tried, only to find that after 15 minutes of just watching Space Invaders go back and forth, it gets monotonous, and then they just said, screw it.
So they just stopped the broadcasting.
They broadcast only the start of it live, but they only went like about 5 minutes and then cut. And then they had people recording and doing commentators because they were told by Atari that the game was going to only last 15 minutes, not an hour and 45 minutes.
Oh my gosh. Do you know if there's footage of that anywhere? Like, I tried to find the footage, but I couldn't really
CNN.
Make that far.
CNN has it. In fact, that's when you watch the night, when you watched High Score from Netflix, which is that show which I'm showcased in it. The producers told me that they went to CNN, which was only like 6 months old at the time. Because CNN came into existence in the early 1980. But they have footage, raw footage, and that's why in the show, there's footage of me as a young child there talking to people at the tournament, because that was from the raw footage.
I didn't realize that that was... my brain is probably just seeing it as pictures. But I remember I watched that. I'm going to have to go back and look for like the exact footage. I would love to see the first couple minutes of that entire tournament. Like, it just fascinating to me how it began. And we laughed about how they called it annual.
It was staged. I mean, yeah. It was staged as if it was a some sort of a TV show.
I'd love to know a little bit more about what standing in line was like at the Topanga Canyon Plaza. What was that like? Because when I look online, it says that there was 10,000 people that came to the competition. But when I heard you talk about it, it sounded like there were a lot more people per regional than what they said. It looked like they just go, oh, it's 10,000, you know, but they didn't account for the fact there was actually 40,000 there.
Oh, that's didn't account is the running gag of the Atari 2600 Space Invaders tournament. when they first came up with the idea, they only thought like 2,500, 5,000 participants was going to happen. They held the very first one in August in San Jose, because, you know, Silicon Valley is actually San Jose, not San Francisco. People confuse the two, but it's really San Jose. And about 25,000 people, somewhere in that range, showed up. It was mayhem. So when they, a month and a half later, when they started doing the Los Angeles, then the Dallas, then the Chicago event, and then followed by the New York events, they were a little bit more organized. But even then, it was insane because they held all these kiosks roped off. To help control the number of people taking turns, they would ask you to pay a $1 entry fee, which the money went to charity. To this day, I still don't know what charity it was. I'm sure if it was Red Cross or something, but some charity. Pay for the fee. They give you a coupon. You get in the line. The line moved fast. It wasn't like a line at Disneyland where you could just read a book or something like that. And it was by design, because the game version we were playing was Space Invaders game one, B difficulty, which makes your base twice as wide. And the judge was instructed that if you start the game by holding the reset key down, which causes a mode where you could shoot two bullets instead of one, you're automatically disqualified. They tell people, no, you only play the single shot version. And the idea was everybody at Atari, when they played this particular version of the game, they don't last a minute. So the person would go, okay, you go to like a turnstile when fries is an actual thing where, okay, you go to register one, register two, register three. You know, and that's why the line was moving pretty quickly. The person would just take your coupon, verify it's a real coupon, not something printed, and then just say, go to kiosk this. Okay, take one, kiosk four, kiosk nine, kiosk 20, kiosk whatever. And because once you get to your kiosk, the judge then just asks your name. He or she writes it down. And then start the game, and then within 30 seconds to 2 minutes, you're dead. And then you're off, and you record the score, it goes on.
I love that there were kids actually cheating, that they were like, you know, I'm going to get away with this.
Oh, yeah. As soon as they saw two bullets flying up, that's it, you're done.
And they didn't even warn them. They just, like, let them cheat, and then they were like, okay, disqualified.
There's a big sign. There were signs everywhere that says, you know, this is grounds for cheating. This is the mode you're going to play.
Okay. I have a bit of a question. I'm a big competitor, and reading and learning that during the finals, they changed the rules on you was so incredible to me. And I want to know how you felt when you were playing. The rules were being changed while you're playing.
When we were playing the games in the regionals, it was sudden death. You start the game, uh-huh. you play until you're dead, and then whatever your score is tabulated, that's what you do. So whoever has the high score wins. I played for somewhere around about an hour play, and I just lost so much interest in playing the game, the aliens landed on me. And so even though I never lost the base, aliens landed on me, game over. And that's when I asked the judge, you know, what's my score? He says 88,000 points. And I go, is that good? It turned out to be the highest score. Well, that should have warned Atari that there are people who play the game for more than 2 minutes.
You're playing for like over an hour. Like Stephanie and I could see like the scene in the movie where like people in the mall are like watching and being like, oh, she's still playing, you know? Like
that was
like this cool montage scene that like your life needs to be a movie is what we're telling you.
It really does.
Now factor in that the other contestants that made it to the finals also had scores comparable to mine, which is every one of them played for over an hour. So Atari. That should have keyed in to Atari that sudden death was not going to happen in 3 minutes.
I mean, so when you guys are there at the finals and all of you have done it sudden death like this the entire time, and then did you know that Atari was changing the rules on you? Or only knew at the very last second?
Yep. What had happened was that the announcer came up, they all had us lined up in a row, and they said, okay, so begins the game, blah, blah, blah. And as far as we were told, it was last man standing. So, you know, sooner or later, somebody's going to get shot, whatever, but whoever's the last person was there is going to be crowned. So effectively, it's, you know, once the fourth person is fallen and you have only one person still playing, then they would just call the game right there. That was the way they were expecting it to be. However, once we started playing the game, that's when people from CBS, CN, etc., they were trying to do like a little running commentary and so forth. I was hearing them behind me. I couldn't actually turn to see them because then I would get slaughtered. But I would be playing. But then after about 15, 20 minutes, all the newscasters just said, screw this. So I'm sitting down there watching. But then it was 20 minutes into the game where the contestant from Chicago, Steve Marmel, the aliens landed on him. So
he's our favorite. He's our favorite little villain in the story. But you guys are friends now, right?
Oh, yeah, we're good friends now. But back then, you know, there was like karma. But he was gone, which of course made the people from Atari and the newscasters all excited, going, oh, we got one down. Okay, when's the next one going down? When's the next? And then they started their commentary again. And then after 10, 15 minutes, they all stopped their commentary. And then an hour and a half goes by, because it was actually more like an hour and 15 more goes by, because it was around 11:45, because they started the contest at 10. That's why I know it was an hour and 45 minutes. At just 15 minutes before noon, the announcer just comes up and says, and so concludes Atari 2600 Space Invaders Tournament. I come to find out later what was happening was news crews were preparing to leave because they could only stay for 2 hours. Yeah. After that, they had to leave because they had other assignments to do. And nobody expected all the contestants, the other four, to last an hour and 45 minutes.
Was this something that you and the other competitors discussed at all when you were in New York for the days before? You weren't like, hey, this can go for a long time. Like none of you guys discussed you just figured, whatever, we'll just go for as long as we have to.
Yeah, we didn't know whether it was going to be timed or was just last man standing. And of course, they were all, because all the regionals was last man standing, you know, just play the game until you die. And then, because there's no extra lives. So when you lose a base, then you have, you know, there's no recovering from that. Once you lose your third base or aliens land, the game's over.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was intended to be a marathon. So like when I trained to play the game, I played marathon mode, just play it. But I just had an aggressive style, which is one reason why I ended up inadvertently being the winner, mm-hmm. because I just happened to have the play style that maximized points. Because, you know, as a competitive gamer, you know that there are different play styles depend on what is the goal of the scenario.
I feel that competitive gaming is a little bit of luck always mixed with talent, right? So in this specific situation, it's kind of unfortunate for your contestant, but at the same time, you know, a little bit of luck and you made it out and you won. And without like a year two or year three or year four, you know, it's just, it is what it is, you know, you won and we're all celebrating your history.
And of course, this is what was said before, is that when I heard the announcer say that,
yes,
I just reacted saying,
crazy.
Does this mean we can stop playing? And I was still playing. I was still focused on the TV and so forth. And he goes like, yeah, it's the contest is over. They're going to, you know, tabulating everyone's score. And that's when I just reached over, just yanked the cartridge out, put it down. And I just sat back in the chair going like, I'm never going to play that game ever again in my life.
You're so funny. I can't even imagine either. At least, like, you didn't really want to be there. Like, the first time your friend brought you in, and then, you know, you're really awesome.
Yeah. Well, look at it from a different point of view. I was sitting in a chair, no breaks, no bathroom breaks.
That's true.
My butt was falling asleep, and I had no idea how longer this is going to keep going. Because, you know, an hour and 45 minutes is a long time.
It
you
is.
Could watch all of Frozen in that amount of time.
Do you still play that game? I have to know. Sometimes you still put in, like, bring out the Atari or play on an emulator. Ah, there it is.
Oh, nice. That's it.
Yep, that's my Atari, and I also have the Space Invaders cartridge. We actually have a little shrine downstairs, our ofrenda, for Dia de los Muertos.
Nice.
And there's an Atari 2600 Space Invaders card on there, as well as some of my original games that I wrote back then.
Oh, I love that.
Me too.
That's awesome.
So let's talk a little about it. You know, it's funny, because I was also a competitor, and I became a game dev during my later years, and it seems like this is a similar path that you took, where you just decided to go and make your own game at that point. Can you let us know a little bit more about that?
Well, what had happened was that before I even entered into the Space Invaders tournament, I got myself an Atari. I was playing it, but I really didn't have that much money. I was working at a JCPenney either at the warehouse, then I worked at the gas station, because back then that's what JCPenney's had, gas stations at the Whitwood Mall. And then I worked in the toy department, which of course gave me some employee discounts, but even then, the money was really because I was buying Apple II stuff. that's where all my money went. But my friend that I was telling you about, the one who took me to the Peggy County Plaza, he bought every game cartridge there was. If it existed, he bought it. So he had this giant stack of boxes of all the cartridges, and he let me borrow them. I would borrow the cartridge, take them home, and thanks to information I got off of the bulletin boards, you know, that was back then, you know, before the internet was a thing, I got schematics and information on how to design my own card reader. So on my Apple II, I had this little cable. I plug it into the cartridge, download the contents of the cartridge. Then I had another card in my Apple II, which had a different cable, which was wired to a cartridge. I took a combat cartridge and it destroyed it and turned this thing into my Apple II, plug it in my Atari, upload the cartridge into the cartridge data into the RAM card, turn on the Atari, and there was a game. And with it, I was able to basically pirate every single Atari cartridge that was ever made. then I went and entered the tournament. But when I got back, I just went back to doing my old stuff, which is just playing with cartridges, collecting them, going on BBSs. But in time, I started to reverse engineering the cartridges themselves, looking at the code that's in there, making notes, figuring out how it worked. I would take an existing game, change a couple of bytes, see what it did. So I said, oh, this is what changes the color registers. This is the colors. And I would make a color chart. Then in time, I had completely reverse engineered the Atari 2600. At the same time I was doing this, I was writing articles for Electronic Games Magazine, And then I was contracted to do two books. One was called How to Beat the Video Games and like How to Beat the Home Video Games. Now, I wasn't a writer, so they had this guy named Tom Hirschfeld actually write the book, but I would tell him what I needed to do. Kind of like how, you know, Art of the Deal was written. It wasn't really written by Donald Trump. It was written by somebody who knew how to write a book, but the anecdotes was told. And that's how I got these books written. But once this was all done and the books were done, I was talking to my publisher, Arnie Katz, at Electronic Games Magazine, and I nonchalantly told him that I was making my own Atari cartridges because I learned how to program it. And he's like, you know how to program the Atari? I know somebody you could talk to. And he got me in touch with the people who owned the Avalon Hill Game Company. And they called me up.
Board games, right? Those guys?
They were big in board games, and they were also doing computer games. They did several games for the Atari 800 and the Apple II, like Talon Guard and Legionnaire and so forth. Back in the 80s, those were huge games.
Yeah.
But they wanted to go into Atari. And so they called me up, and on that call, they hired me on the spot, sent me an overnight letter with a plane ticket, and some small amount of money. And with that, I then grabbed a suitcase, got my Apple II, my other stuff into it, got on the plane, and flew to Towson, Maryland. And that's when I started programming Atari 2600 cartridges.
You're like, I'm out of here. That's awesome. Yeah, I'm
totally self-taught, even to this day.
That is such an awesome story. It was so different then. I love that you get
plane tickets from companies to just fly you out places. Yeah. Just like as a 17-year-old, really, at that point, just be like, hey, come on out.
They thought I was 18. I told them I was 18.
Yeah.
Rebecca, why don't we talk a little bit about what you've been up to these days? What are you doing? Are you still developing games?
Oh, yeah. I'm working on a updated version of Auto Duel.
Okay. So you've been doing games for like almost 40 years. Oh my God. That is so awesome.
You've been a pioneer in this industry, like, mm-hmm. for sure. I mean, founding Interplay is such a big deal.
One of the founders. I wasn't the only one.
Right. One of four, right?
Yes.
And I mean, I've heard game developers talk about how important Interplay was to them. What year did you leave?
Well, I left in 1995. Remember, Interplay was formed because all four of us were fired from Boone Corporation when they closed the company down. So it was like, we're sitting around the table like, well, we're fired. What are we going to do? Let's form a game company. Sure, why not? That's how it got founded.
And it became a pretty big company. I mean, I think there was 500 huge employees. And mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, we had even Lucasfilm wanted to merge with us. That never happened. We eventually bought Virgin Interactive. I mean... We had an investment from Universal MCA. It was 11 and a half year roller coaster ride because, you know, the first few years we were struggling and starving. But then later on, it was like we had all this money. It was like crazy. And then we crashed and burned. Like,
but you developed a lot of games in that time period. What's your proudest achievement in
it would have to be Bard's Tale 3, The Thief of Fate.
Aww.
That's awesome. The game that I'm the most proud of. My second most proud of is Dragon Wars, which was tentatively titled Bard's Tale 4, but that, you know, when EA was doing their own Bard's Tale 4, and we lost the ability to use the intellectual property, it became Dragon Wars. And that was War of the Dragons and Project X and all sorts of names, but all my source code says Bard's Tale 4 on it. In fact, when I look at it, it still says on there, Bard's Tale 4 by Rebecca Heinem and blah, blah, blah.
That's pretty amazing. What made you so? And you also, I love that you programmed Easter eggs into the game too.
Like, oh yeah.
How did that come about? That you were like, I'm gonna make sure I'm, because I read that it was like you wanted to make sure that nobody could ever sort of take the credit away from you. Was that really where it came from, or was it something else?
When I was at Boone Corporation, we were making game cartridges. I was doing Final Eclipse, and then there was two games of Moody, not Moody, that was the choice game. There was Robin Hood and Chuck Norris Super Kicks. But when the games were released, they were sold by Zonix, which is a division of KTEL, as in KTEL Records. Small world. Huh. They made certain that people's names were not in the game unless it's like really buried in the manual, which no one reads. I also had a feeling that some of the people that was working at Interplay were going to try to hog all the credit of the games that I worked on. So to ensure that there was, I put something in each game that the only way it could have been put in there was because I worked on it. And it helped because there have been people who tried to take credit of games that I worked on. And I would say, well, why don't you go to the Temple of the Mad God in Bard's Tale and type in the word burger and explain why the monsters immediately say, you have uttered the most unholy word, prepare to die, and then your party is slaughtered. The reason it's in there is to tell the world, Becky Heinemann worked on that game no matter what anybody says.
I love it. This industry just totally tries to take sometimes. It's so important, especially as women, that we're able to like say, hey, I did this actually. Yeah. Good for you.
You know, I really love it. I've never seen like an Easter egg story that was because you didn't want to be forgotten and you actually did it.
Adventure for the Atari 2600.
Really?
Was like that too?
Warren Robinette, he was the programmer of Adventure. He worked at Atari and he was doing a bunch of Atari 2600 games. At the time, Activision came out and iMagic came out and they were showcasing the names of the programmers. And he was like, when are you going to showcase us? And the manager said no. So we did this game called Adventure, but he made an Easter egg where if you go into this maze, there is a little tiny dot that exists. It's just an object of the game. It's just a dot. You pick up the dot, walk to another area of the game in which there's this barrier on one wall, which is a little strange that it's there. If you are carrying the dot, you can walk through the barrier. In there is a room which it has written in a string, vertical, created by Warren Robinette.
That's very really cool. Yeah.
So Warren Robin, and that was actually part of my inspiration of how I could sign my games. Now I couldn't put my name in there because that would be too easy to find, because they did have sometimes later on, they were like, okay, how did Becky sign this? And they looked for my name and searched and stuff. And there was one time in which I wrote something like Commodore sucks, Apple rules, and so forth. And it actually pissed off some user because they were scanning the disk trying to cheat the game. And they saw the sector, which the string was in the stuff, Commodore sucks, Apple rules. And he sent a letter to Interplay saying, how dare you say the Commodore sucks and Apple rules? And they're like, the game doesn't say that, but it's in the disk where it says
it's that. Before we could go and pop off on Twitter or something. Like, I'm going to write a strongly worded letter about this. Commodores.
Oh, talk about strong letters. When I did Bard's Tale, when we did Bard's Tale 1, 2, and 3, I've had several times where somebody would send me a letter with a Bible in it saying, how dare you godless heathens write this satanic game? Read this book for the truth! And so forth. And I got like about 5 or 6 of them during my tenure at Interplay.
Wow.
I don't know if it's the same person. All I know is that, okay, another Bible, I'll just toss it on the shelf. It's like, whatever.
Wow. People got serious about that.
They still do. I bet. They still do. You know, when Cyberpunk was delayed, the death threats that the dev were getting, holy moly.
Blizzard's going through that too with Shadowlands. Like, people get really upset when they don't get their games, you know, the way that they want them. It's so funny. This industry is strange because it's filled with so much creativity and at the same time, like, so much entitlement too from both the players and, you know, publishers and so many people involved. You know, for you, Becky, you've been in the industry for 40 years, both as a player and a developer. For you, what do you wish to see in gaming today? Like, what is something that you kind of hope for the industry as it continues to grow and evolve from this point?
I wish to see more civility. I mean, jerks have been around even back in the 80s. Back then, they would send me strongly worded letters or literal packages of dog poop. Or Bibles, because my games are for unclean heathens. But they never did anything back then what they're doing today, because today you have people swatting you, doxing you, Or now the worst thing going on is making deep fakes with your face on porn stars.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it's totally fake, but unless somebody's pointed that out, they think they got nudes. And this is stuff that didn't exist back in the 80s, 90s, even the 2000s. I mean, it's kind of scary how people, through what they think is anonymity, can be super jerks instead of just plain old jerks. But right now, which is more contemporary, is that we live in the United States, in which our country is utterly divided by Group A and Group B, who hate each other and do not do anything for a common ground. And once upon a time, we were all civil about this, where people had difference of opinions, different ideas, and we just sit down and talk about it, try to understand the other side. Now it's, let's just throw mud or ruin the lives of the person on the other side without getting to know them.
Yeah.
Gaming. We have, like myself, I would sometimes have to use a male-sounding or generic-sounding pseudonym to play, because as soon as I go in with an unusual moniker of Burke or Becky, more often than not, I get somebody who starts saying very inappropriate things to me on the chat line. And it's all because, oh, somebody's here who dares to have a vagina. Yeah. And that's the only criteria.
Yeah. They're like, oh, girl, we should be a jerk now. Yeah, that has happened so many times, I think, to all of us. That I feel like sometimes in more recent years, it's strange because it's both gotten better and gotten worse. Like it feels like like gaming has become more accepting. It's kind of gotten back to the beginning of where we were, you know, promoting games to men and women. Like if you look back in like old Atari commercials, like I've talked about this before, there's like boys and girls and moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas and everybody playing the system together as a family entertainment system. And I feel like through the years, like it kind of got lost in that with like marketing and whatnot and became like a very male endeavor. And, you know, and girls kind of got shut out of that. And I think over the last like maybe decade, like the last 10 years that I've personally been in games, I've watched it kind of go through a few phases. I mean, it definitely hit like a bad bump around like 2014 Gamergate-ish kind of time. Mm-hmm. But that's when it all really started to get more vitriolic. Like, while it's more accepting and we say, well, let's make games for all people and make sure that everybody has accessibility as much as we can and show women in the games so that women feel, you know, that they're reflected in the games. I feel like that's all gotten better from the dev side. But at the same time, we have this crazy divided, you know, culture that also exists simultaneously. I'm not sure if that's due to the rise of streaming or just like the, you know, curation of that like 2014 era just continuing to sort of, you know, pop up because of politics and whatnot. But yeah, it's definitely a strange time because it's gotten better and worse. Do you feel that too?
I do. The issue you have, that really is the root cause here, is that there's still managers and studio heads that are misogynistic, fill in the blank with nasty words. Because they feel that only men should be able to play, or they're just misogynists in general. And their misogyny trickles down to the rest of the company, which is why you hear about sexual harassment issues at some game studios. Mm-hmm. All the rest of the game studios out there have realized that people who are LGBT, people who are of color, people with vaginas, they spend money. And we want that money. We want that green money. And so therefore, they go on a campaign to make certain that whoever works for them is instilled with the idea that the games must be completely inclusive for every human being on the planet, regardless of anything. Because if you're human and you've got a bank account, we want to tap into that. And that is what's helping, the number one reason helping equality in gaming, at the same time giving companies incentives to police bad behavior and get rid of it, because you'd say, yeah, of course you want the misogynists' money too, but the people who are not misogynists tend to outnumber the misogynists by great number. So, do I want this small group of people and I cater to them and get their money, or do I want this giant group of people that I want to cater to and get their money? let's go to the group that's, you know, not misogynists. So even the misogynists are going to say, oh no, I will never buy a game from fill in the blank company again because they won't cater to my, you know, infantile needs. The answer more often than not now is bye bye and don't let the door hit your butt on the way out.
They're still going to buy the games anyway.
They're still going to buy the games anyways. That's the hilarious thing. They say they're going to boycott, but they really don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have that at all in when you were doing game design stuff?
Yeah. I think for me, it was really, really apparent, especially because I was working on narrative games, single players with big, big teams, like 1,000 people teams. And if I didn't have a female writer to fight the good fight about the female characters and a creative director that was open-minded, that had two little girl, you know, that was in a healthy marriage, without these people, there probably would not have been any women characters in most of the games that I made like 15 years ago. So now, it, like Rebecca mentioned, it's completely new era now, but back then it was a fight every day that a woman characters, they were not just a token woman in the game. She could have a personality. She could be fleshed and have depth and be, you know, not violent just or exactly, or be funny, or like, you know, woman was not her personality. Her personality was, you know, something else than being a woman, which was, to be quite frank, when I started being involved into gaming and knowing a little bit about game, woman was your only personality. You were the token woman in the game, and you had to kind of be everything, badass, sexy, funny, like not annoying. Like all the women characters had to have pretty much all the qualities in nothing annoying, or else, you know, they would get cut, or, you know.
And of course, let's also take that further. In fact, back then, when you did get your token female character, she had to be skinny as a rail, young, and have boobs that would cause people to fall over flat on their face. It's like, okay, that's not a human being. I don't know what it is, but it's not a woman I know.
It definitely gave me a complex as a little girl.
Lara Croft's first incarnation, shall I use that as an example?
Yeah.
Yeah, she did have it going on up there. Because like as a very small chested girl myself, I would look at that stuff and be like, oh man, I'm screwed. Like, I'm never gonna look like that.
Yeah.
So it was nice to see when game like design started to change a little bit more.
And yeah.
Now but females have a lot more depth.
I played a game yesterday on my stream and I chose like the fat character option. It was written fat. So I clicked on it and it was like it gender woman. I clicked on it just to see what they meant by fat, and she looked actually kind of like me, and I don't consider myself fat, so I was so upset. No. I was like, why is the fat option like a regular woman size? So where it still happened.
I think they call it plus happened. Size, not fat.
It was written fat on the screen. I was
That's
I couldn't
a
believe
failure.
It
whoever yeah. wrote that was like, okay,
I couldn't
oh
believe
my
it
god
yeah
was that made just, in America or where was that
in France
oh
so it still
goodness.
Happened
bad translation
still happened it could yeah. be it could be
maybe yeah.
But yeah, so just to know we're still not there yet, guys. We're working
we're
on
there.
It but
you have a company now, right, called Old School that you're doing are you developing any Old School are you Old School
Ooh, okay
we're
okay.
Old School
that's like amazing it. So what are you guys developing right now, like what are you working on?
We entered an agreement with Steve Jackson Games and we're bringing back Auto Duel.
Very cool.
So remember, drive offensively.
That's great. So do you guys, I mean, are you in the, where are you at in the process right now? You're just
we're
in the
still
beginning?
In the early development stages right now because I'm trying to get some artists and stuff like that together. I mean, I've already got the game designed. I know what the game's going to be, but imagine a Mad Max-like RPG in which you're doing missions. Now it's not Mad Max where the whole world's screwed over. In the world of Auto Duel, it's more like best way to say Judge Dredd, in which you have big cities but between them is a wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get in the city, it might as well be Blade Runner. So very futuristic, cool. Lots of people, stuff like that. But when you want to go to another city, and it's based on the United States. So you go to like Denver, Boston, etc. And you get a mission and you get in your car and then you have to cross the wasteland to go ahead and do your mission, which then you get paid. And then, of course, there's also the auto duels, kind of like the Thunderdome, where it's basically both demolition derby racing games, which, again, you compete for prizes and stuff. And the whole point is to earn enough money to deck out your car to just go ahead and crush everything.
That's really cool. That's really cool.
I love
cool.
that 40 years later, you know, you're still making games and still a part of the industry and, you know, fighting the good fight. And, you know, we're really honored that you came on the podcast and let us tell your story of, you know, being the first gaming champion and just coming here and celebrating the anniversary with us and filling us in on the tournament. Just thank you so much for all your contributions to gaming and for coming on here and talking to us today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. And I really, really appreciate that you're doing your part to help remember the history, because when the video game crash occurred in 83, everything before 83 kind of got erased from history. So many people think that Nintendo was the first gaming consoles and so forth. No, there was a whole history behind that. And that's where I got my start. And just seeing things like High Score and in Europe podcast here is just warms my heart. So at least people will remember these things and hopefully learn the lessons, because much like back then, things are different. The present day, some things are worse, some things are better, but thankfully the better is winning over the worst. And I look forward to seeing more and more of the best.
Oh, well, we are here to hopefully remember all of it. Stephanie and I say we feel like little gaming grandmas, and we want to make sure that, you know, that none of it gets lost, and that we really talk about the important stories in the industry. And yours was just like the perfect first one to talk about. It really sets the stage for the way that gaming should be seen, which is inclusive, that women are involved, and we should know that. That is the way it is. So we really appreciate everything you've done.
Well, thank you. And as seen here, women have been since the beginning of time. You know, beginning of the gaming world. We've always been here.
Yep. And we're here to stay.
And we're here to stay.
We're not going anywhere.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Becky. People can find Becky on social media at Burger Becky. And where she puts out some pretty great tweets. I really liked your zombie haiku, the brains. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Becky, for coming on. And everybody, please make sure that you're following her on Burger Becky. And you can hear her episode. We'll go ahead, I guess, and put it in the for those watching on YouTube, we'll put it in the description so you can link it to it.
Yeah, and if you're just catching this for the first time, remember that we're releasing an episode every Tuesday on the Game Diaries on your favorite podcast app or website. Becky, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Bye, everyone.